It's Tuesday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, Hillary Clinton appears in firm control of the race to the White House.
The Saudis have, I think, been targeting civilian targets all the way through this conflict.
Missiles fly by a U.S. Navy vessel near Yemen. Also ahead, China seeks a greater maritime presence, and aspiring entertainers have a new place to learn and grow. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump faced new headwinds Monday, with the party's top elected official all but conceding that Democrat Hillary Clinton will win the race for the White House, and new polls showing her surging to a decided edge. House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan told his Republican colleagues in a conference call he would no longer defend Trump's often impolite comments that have offended many voters, including lewd remarks about women in a 2005 tape in which the brash real estate mogul boasted how he could grope them because he was a celebrity. The candidates debated almost 24 hours ago in St. Louis, Missouri. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone is in the studio, and despite that damaging video, Donald Trump was very aggressive in the debate.
It was really something to observe that he was so aggressive against Clinton for much of the evening. He really took it to Clinton on a number of issues: the email, Bill Clinton's past, Obamacare, her foreign policy record as Secretary of State. This was something that his core supporters and a lot of Clinton critics in the Republican Party, I think, probably enjoyed. This is something they wanted to see for a long time. So I'm sure it was probably very satisfying to them. But the question in the context of the debate was, Trump came in already trailing in the polls. He needs to broaden his base, not confirm it. And if all you're doing is ginning up your loyal supporters, what are you doing to cast a wider net that you'll need on Election Day? And the consensus among a lot of the experts is that he didn't do much. He kept a negative focus on her, but he also cannot escape the shadow of this videotape. And in fact, it's causing continued problems between himself and key members of the Republican Party.
An amazing rift within the Republican Party. I've heard several analysts today talking about it being a civil war.
It's pretty much close to that. I mean, you had the House Speaker, Paul Ryan, in a conference call with fellow House Republicans on Monday, telling them that he was not going to defend Donald Trump anymore. He was not going to appear on the campaign trail on his behalf anymore. And that they should, really dig in, defend their majorities in Congress, so that if Hillary Clinton is elected, she doesn't have a blank check when she comes into the White House. Well, some of them, this was tantamount to conceding the election to Clinton. And so there's already a lot of pushback. And the reason for that is that a lot of the key House members and some of the Senate races, they will depend on Trump followers getting out to vote for them. So they are loath to in any way antagonize or feel as though they are betraying the Trump followers right now. But this has put the Republican Party in a terrible bind. And 4 weeks to go until Election Day, this is the last thing you want if you're hoping your party can win the White House.
On Election Day, it always comes down to turnout. Is there a worry among the Democrats that, they're so far ahead, why bother go out and vote?
I think that is a concern. And it's been a concern all along because it was going to be a challenge for Hillary Clinton to duplicate the great turnout efforts in the previous two elections under Barack Obama. He energized this new coalition, the younger voters, minorities, younger women, and they came out in full force. And this whole phenomenon has helped to overwhelm what was the traditional white working class vote that carried Republican candidates to victory. But I think you're right. The Democrats are going to really now work hard. In fact, I heard Hillary Clinton today in Detroit telling the people at the rally to get out and vote. So they are definitely focused on that. And who knows, if they do build a big lead, you're right, the sense of complacency could come into play. And they both parties will be working hard on the turnout, but Trump has not done much of a job at creating a turnout operation, and the Democrats have an advantage there.
Well, our coalition with VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone is rock solid. We thank you so much, Jim, for spending a few moments with us.
My pleasure.
Time now to check out what people are talking about on the web in relation to last night's debate. And as usual, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, joins me right here in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
You mentioned that apart from the candidates, people are talking about a person who asked a question at the town hall. Tell us about that.
Sure. So, Jim, if you're undecided on what to be for Halloween, here's an idea for you. In fact, it appears that this person gave a lot of people Halloween costume ideas. Some media outlets are going as far as saying he's a real winner of the second debate. His name is Kenneth Bone, and he asked a question about energy, and he became an instant internet sensation with his earnest manner and a cozy sweater.
Okay, it'll keep you warm. So what are people saying about him specifically?
Well, mostly about his sweater. So he wore a red cable knit zip-up sweater, and that specific sweater he wore is sold out on Amazon for sizes small to extra large the last time I checked before I came to the studio. But since Twitter users are, you know, sharing updated info about its availability at various stores, you can turn to social media for that. It's funny, though, that the red sweater was actually his plan B. He initially wanted to wear an olive suit, but it split in his car on the way over. He shared that story during an interview this morning, and he said, "What can I say? I just got fat." Since then, people are liking him even more for his frank manner. Here's an example from Chicago-based reporter Scott Smith. He tweeted, "Let's all try to be a little like Ken Bone today. Humble, wise, enjoying the hell out of a sweater."
Okay, and something that fits. What else happens to be trending?
Jim, Ken Bone's outfit is not the only outfit at the venue that caught people's attention. Many Twitter users are also wondering if Donald Trump's wife, Melania Trump's choice of her blouse, is, quote-unquote, throwing a shade at either her husband or to the Clintons. The pink Gucci blouse has a bow that's called in the fashion industry as a bow with another word that Trump used in the leaked tape. I'll leave that to your imagination to find out. Jim, back to you.
Okay, something for you to look up online. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. And you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE or on our individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: North Korean flood victims caught in nuclear standoff, 14 killed in suicide car bombing in Afghanistan, President Duterte statements highlight uncertain Philippine policies, Australian officials pledge support for asylum claim of Kem Lay widow, Asia investors and traders bet on Clinton. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The U.S. Navy said two missiles fired from rebel-held Yemen struck the Red Sea as the destroyer USS Mason passed by. There was no damage or casualties in Sunday's incident. However, a week earlier, a United Arab Emirates-flagged vessel was struck and damaged. The latest missile launches came hours after thousands of people, many of them armed, protested in front of UN offices in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, following an airstrike Saturday that killed 140 people and wounded hundreds more. That attack, believed to be carried out by a Saudi coalition aircraft, has been roundly condemned. Riyadh has launched an investigation. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales tells VOA's Victor Beatty that he suspects Saudi Arabian aircraft were responsible.
The fact that there were some senior Houthis in the audience, probably they had some sort of intelligence that they'd be there. The Saudis have, I think, been targeting civilian targets all the way through this conflict. I note that I think if Human Rights Watch, for example, commented that perhaps a third of all the casualties have been civilians, in hospitals and schools bombed. The Saudis, of course, deny it at every step of the way, but it can't be anybody else.
Is either side making any progress in ending this conflict?
I think probably the Houthis would like to, but I think the Saudis basically wanting a winner-take-all result. So they had peace talks in Kuwait, which might resume again next month. But the problem has been that the Saudis have basically submitted conditions to the Houthis that they know will not be acceptable. I lay down all your arms and withdraw from the areas that you've conquered or captured. The Houthis will not do that. They could not afford to do that. They know that that would be very much to their disadvantage.
How likely is the peace process to result in an end of hostilities?
I think it requires the U.S. to speak rather sternly to the Saudis. I think it's being run by a very aggressive son of the king, and I think there's a lot of people in Saudi Arabia who are very concerned about the nature of his policies, especially in this area, and somehow or other he has to be hauled back. And I think only the U.S. has that sort of influence.
Amin Saikal of the Australian National University was asked if the Saudi air campaign had any effect against the pro-Iranian Houthi rebels who took over the capital and much of the countryside 2 years ago.
They have not been able to dislodge the Houthis from Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. If anything, these air strikes have caused a lot of devastation and have resulted in killing of thousands of people. And I think that's why the American government has voiced a serious concern and has said that it's going to really review its support for these Saudi-led coalition operations in Yemen.
Professor, the UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad Al Hussein in a report recently said that coalition airstrikes are responsible for 60% of civilian casualties during the year-long span of its air campaign last year.
That is enormous. And I think, again, that makes it very imperative for the Saudis and their allies to really review the whole situation and, if necessary, to really pull back these air operations because so far they have not really resulted in any way opening the way for a peaceful settlement of the Yemeni conflict. If anything, it has caused a lot of miseries for the Yemenis people. And we know that something like more than half of the population are under the age of starvation. There's not enough water, there's not enough food, and they're under constant bombardments, and these bombardments are basically killing more civilians than really targeting the rebels.
The United Nations in August estimated that at least 10,000 people have died in the conflict since the Saudi air campaign began in March 2015, while some 3 million have been displaced. China's efforts to become a global maritime power have been drawing more attention in the United States. In recent months, American analysts who study Chinese maritime capabilities have offered fresh perspectives on Beijing's motivations and how Washington should react to them. In this week's VOA China 360 podcast, my colleague Michael Lippin brings you analysis from retired U.S. Rear Admiral Michael McDivitt, a senior fellow at the CNA Corporation in Washington. CNA is a federally funded research group whose Center for Naval Analysis works with the U.S. Department of the Navy. In a June report by CNA, McDivitt shared his findings about why China wants to become a maritime power, and he tells VOA's China 360 that Beijing has several key motives.
Strategically, their situation has changed dramatically over the last 20 to 25 years in the sense that they are incredibly dependent now on trade that travels mainly by sea. They have over 1 million people working abroad and just in Africa. Who knows how many else, others somewhere in the Gulf and what have you. So they have lots of Chinese citizens abroad, and they've had in the past to evacuate them because they're in some fairly dangerous countries, such as Yemen or Libya. And the resources in the sea are seen as very important for China, and particularly the fish. As the demand signal for protein has gone up in Chinese life, as people become more well-to-do, they want more protein and fishes. Fish provides a large amount of that. In fact, last year, China consumed 50% of all the fish consumed in the world. And so fish are a major protein source. So as well as they're looking for gas and oil in offshore areas like the South China Sea and East China Sea. So the other thing, of course, is the fact that their unresolved strategic or sovereignty issues are maritime in nature. Taiwan is an island. That's inherently a maritime military problem. The islands that they claim in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, are obviously inherently maritime. And finally, because they've studied history, and they've reached the conclusion that all of the great powers in world history that lasted any time at all were maritime powers as well as, or that contributed to their great power status. Obviously, the most recent example is the United States. So this combination of things is what really is a determining factor.
Retired U.S. Rear Admiral McDivitt also provided some new insights into why China is intensifying its efforts to achieve maritime power status. For more, as well as differing views about how the United States should respond to China's moves, you can listen to our VOA China 360 podcast on our website. All you have to do is go to voanews.com, click on Listen at the top of the website, and then select our broadcast programs. Just scroll down to the bottom of the page, and you can also find the podcast on Twitter at voachina360. And, of course, you're welcome to subscribe to it and many of our other offerings on iTunes. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. It's been just over 2 years since comedian and actor Robin Williams committed suicide. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about a new center in New York that is named for Williams, and it aims to help those seeking a career in entertainment.
The Robin Williams Center for actors, broadcasters, and recording artists will serve as a nurturing space for those who are trying to break into show business. The center features a 154-seat state-of-the-art theater and screening room. It will also have a multi-camera and broadcasting capability, and the center will be the home of the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations and the Business Educational Initiatives. At the center's opening, Billy Crystal, Robin Williams' longtime friend and collaborator on 10 comic relief broadcasts, said the center will provide free classes for the thousands of actors and comedians who are trying to break into show business.
Well, I think it means a great deal to all of this. 40,000 SAG-AFTRA members in New York City alone. So to have a place that is dedicated to helping the people who are not working and people who need help and connection and mentoring and just a place to come and feel connected, that's a fantastic thing, and that it has his spirit attached to it, which is a tremendous force. I think it's a great thing that SAG has done.
Crystal remembered Robin Williams as someone whose generosity and gentleness of spirit brought happiness to millions.
He was an incredibly talented man, we know, but he was also gentle of spirit and nothing but sharing and kindness, and I think that's what people need when, you know, times get rough, that you know that this building, if you walk in, and Robin was a big hugger. He was, and you'll feel that, I think, when you walk into this building.
This is the first time that Williams's family has agreed to let his name be attached to something. Whoopi Goldberg, the third part of the comic relief trio, said that Robin Williams would probably be cracking jokes about the center, but she said she also deeply misses her friend.
I think he would think it was the silliest thing he'd ever heard. And he would make all kinds of jokes about it. And, you know, there's just not enough of them for me. You can't name enough things after him. I'd rather have him.
The Robin Williams Center is funded by a $16 million capital campaign that includes $6 million for the center and $10 million for the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's endowment. The center is located in the heart of New York's Theater District. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. You'll find us anytime you like at our website, voanews.com. Also, be sure to check us out on Facebook. VOA Now is the place to go. And follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for stopping by and having a listen. Come back when you have a chance and have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On October 12, 1492, three Spanish ships under the leadership of Christopher Columbus landed on an island in what is today the Bahamas. The anniversary of that event, observed annually in the United States as Columbus Day, initiated a vast global exchange of foods, animals, plants, peoples, and diseases that transformed the world, known today as the Columbian Exchange. For that reason, 1492 is considered by most historians to be the most significant year in modern world history. World population has increased more than four times since 1492, doubling between 1650 and 1850. Although a number of contributing factors are responsible for such enormous growth, clearly the most significant is an increased and improved food supply. The addition to the food supply of Native American food plants such as maize, potato, tomato, peanuts, manioc, pineapple, peppers, and cocoa beans was the most significant factor. The potato became the most important food source for the poor in Central and Northern Europe. Maize and manioc were introduced to Africa in the 16th century and replaced traditional African crops as the continent's most important staple food crops. The introduction to China of New World food crops, in particular potatoes, corn, and peanuts, resulted in a population boom between 1500 and 1650. By the 18th century, over one-third of the world's population lived in China. The Columbian Exchange was global, introducing new foods to every corner of the world. Before 1492, there were no oranges in Florida, no bananas in Ecuador, no paprika in Hungary. The exchange brought tomatoes to Italy, coffee to Colombia and Indonesia, pineapples to Hawaii, rubber trees to Africa, chili peppers to Thailand, China, and India, and chocolate to Switzerland. The landfall of the three small ships on an island in the Bahamas brought about unprecedented change in the course of history. It shaped the future of humankind for centuries to come, not just because of the discovery of a new continent, but because it brought about regular contact between the Earth's hemispheres, engendering trade, allowing for an exchange of ideas, and creating connections and encounters between cultures. In 1492, the peoples of the world began to come together as a global society, and that is good for all peoples.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.